wonderful Wizard of Oz. Well, here he is, the Wizard of Wiz, if ever a Wiz there was. If ever, oh, ever a Wiz there was, the Wizard of Oz has won. Because of the wonderful things he does. We're off to see the Wizard, the wonderful Wizard of Oz.
This is The Wizards of Money, your money and financial management series, but with a twist. My name is Smithy, and I'm a wizard watcher in the Land of Oz. This is the 20th edition of The Wizards of Money, and it is entitled The Battle of the Dragons, Oil versus Insurance. In this, the 20th edition of The Wizards of Money, we're going to take a look at why it's not easy being green when everybody wants to be in the black. We'll discuss the relationship between black gold, the future of the world's most powerful cartel, the changing climate, and the powerful industry that loses big bucks on bad weather. First, we'll discuss that ever-important oil price range, that target price range per barrel of oil within which both producers and consumers are happy to continue business as usual. But we can't discuss that without also talking about that thing at the heart of the oil markets, so despised in all our free market teachings, the cartel. In this case, the OPEC cartel, of course. And given what's just happened in Iraq and continuing US policy towards OPEC countries, we'll see where OPEC might be headed in the future. We'll look at the indications that the OPEC cartel may face tough times ahead and the outlook for the fossil fuel industry in general. For, while they may be thinking their future looks pretty rosy, they may be just about to meet their match. You see, what has now become old Europe is also the home of another fearsome and ancient creature of the capital markets that is none too pleased about the world's use of fossil fuels. Despite all the denials in the US media, the huge global insurers and reinsurance companies accept climate change as a fact. Furthermore, they accept that climate change is induced by human activity. And climate change is costing them big bucks. With key seats on the UN climate change panel and as powerful advocates of the Kyoto Protocol, but most of all, with trillions of dollars to vote with in the capital markets, the insurance industry has both the motive and the power to do something about global climate change. For this journey through the oil and insurance markets, we'll speak with an executive at the world's largest reinsurer, Munich Re, and with several oil markets consultants in the oil state of Texas, and with the head of research at Greenpeace, who just had a party at the ExxonMobil shareholders meeting in Dallas, Texas.
Iraq, today, being an OPEC country in theory, is also a country under the control of the biggest consumer that OPEC has been formed to begin with in an adversarial relationship. And that is indeed a huge conflict.
We threw a party at the Exxon AGM the day before the meeting took place. We showed up at their headquarters with 32 members of the Global Warming Crimes Unit. We went inside the building dressed in suits and to deliver our list of charges against the company for sabotaging the Kyoto Protocol and other progress and trying to undermine the science of climate change for more than a decade.
There is no connection between global warming and the production of carbon dioxide. In fact, our calculations suggest that carbon dioxide should increase to as much as 5% of the atmosphere to rationalize a wholesale increase in temperature, not the part per million that it is right now.
And who funds your research projects?
I have had funding from the United States government, I have had projects with Halliburton, projects with Shell Oil Company. I have had research funded by El Paso Corporation, which is a natural gas company.
Greenpeace has been working with the insurance industry since the early 90s. In fact, there was a conference held in 1991 in Florida, actually with the insurance industry, where we saw some real consciousness and some hope that they could be a proactive force to push for a good climate treaty and absolute reductions in greenhouse gases. I can give you a couple names of people who have worked really closely with Swiss Re and Munich Re. World Wildlife Fund has done a bit of work with them, as have some of the socially responsible investment community folks, the same folks who were hammering Exxon yesterday at the annual general meeting. They've had a really good dialogue with the reinsurers.
Well, my name is Thomas Loster. I work in the GeoRisks Research Department at the Munich Reinsurance Company. This is the leading reinsurance company of the world, and they want to know about the risks they take. So they have installed a research team looking into the whole global issues, and global warming is a big threat to the communities and might play a role in insurance claims. That's why we do a lot of research in that field.
And do you believe that this change in nature is human-induced?
The change in the climate is definitely man-made.
E.T., what is the meaning of this? I've just received this memo. In the one day since you inherited Global Oil, you've managed to dispose of assets worth over $6 billion.
Listen, this company's been doing some pretty heavy things over the years, Ryan. It's going to start getting beautiful or this planet's headed for oblivion.
My God, you're right, E.T.
A cartel is formed when a dominant group of suppliers or producers of a product conspire to keep prices artificially high. Basically, they conspire to hold back supply so that prices are held above where they would fall if you allowed full competition between these producers. The most powerful cartel in the world is, of course, OPEC, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries. It consists of 11 countries altogether, and these are Saudi Arabia, Iran, Iraq, Qatar, United Arab Emirates, Kuwait, Nigeria, Algeria, Libya, Indonesia, and Venezuela. For various reasons, OPEC also does not want the price of oil to get too high either. And so the price of oil ends up getting managed within a certain magical price range. I asked Professor Dermot Gately, Professor of Economics at New York University, to explain this magical price range.
They're trying to keep control of the oil market and the price in particular within a relatively narrow range on the order of maybe $22 to $28. They're concerned if the price gets too low because that means that their revenue will fall. And that means they're probably putting too much oil into the market for what the market is really demanding from OPEC. So if the price gets too low, then they're going to have to be concerned about reducing the amount of oil that they're pumping and trying to sell into that market. On the other hand, if the price gets too high, although it benefits them in the short run in that they'll get lots of additional revenue, the problem is a long-run problem for them in so far as a very high price won't be sustainable in the long run. It will force oil demand to cut back over the long run, and it will encourage non-OPEC oil production to expand.
And do you have any predictions about where oil prices are going to go in?
Well, most analysts predict or project that oil prices are likely to stay in the range of $20 to $25 for the next couple of decades. And certainly we have, there's enough oil reserves in the world where that could occur, that we could continue consuming and increasing our consumption of oil for the next couple of decades. This
the people that project oil at $20-$25 for the next 2 decades or so are also projecting that there's going to be a doubling of capacity and production coming out of the Persian Gulf. So we will be, according to these projections, we will be even more dependent on Persian Gulf oil in the future than we are now, at least going out to the year 2025.
But the natural question to ask about OPEC these days is this. What will happen to the cartel now that America, the world's largest oil consumer, is running Iraq? Isn't it bizarre that for the first time ever in the history of big cartels, the biggest customer of the cartel, the United States in this case, actually has a seat at the table of the cartel? The cartel is supposed to be in a conspiracy against its customers. Often when you have serious questions like this about oil, you find yourself going to Texas for all the answers. I pose this question to Professor Michael Economides, Professor of Chemical Engineering and a consultant to the oil industry at the University of Houston.
This is the biggest dilemma. It's almost like a catch-22 situation. I have written about this in a number of major editorials in the newspapers. So let me give you the short version of this. The United States today is what we call the belligerent occupier. The Vienna Convention that describes the duties of the belligerent occupier is very explicit. There are very draconian, in fact, requirements for that. It's very simple. The oil resources of Iraq must be used for the benefit of the Iraqi people. And I'm sure you've heard many statements by members of this administration suggesting that this is precisely what they're going to do. Now, what does it mean? It creates some very interesting problems. Let's look at OPEC and Iraq. How is the United States administration in Iraq going to handle OPEC? For instance, imagine a representative of this administration in the next OPEC meeting. How is he going to act? Is he going to go along, for instance, with supply cuts if OPEC chooses to do so and therefore bolster the prices and indeed help the Iraqi treasury, which we're supposed, the United States is supposed to be the guardian of based on the identity of the United States as the belligerent occupier? Or is the Iraqi representative going to go against OPEC supply cuts, which actually will further collapse the prices, reduce the prices, benefiting the United States and other consuming nations, but being a contravention of the Vienna Convention, since that would certainly hurt Iraq if the price of oil collapses, and since oil is really the only source of revenue, credible source of revenue for the country. It becomes really a huge dilemma for the administration of the now occupied Iraq, for which, of course, the United States has been recently given the free rein through the United Nations Security Council resolution, the recent resolution. That becomes an issue. Now, obviously, Iraq's position with respect to OPEC is a very important one because Iraq is potentially the second largest producer in OPEC. It has definitely the second largest petroleum reserves after Saudi Arabia. So that is a very important question.
I also decided to pose this question to a finance professor, Professor Craig Perong, at the University of Houston to see how the oil state's financial world feels about this tricky situation.
There's a potentially fundamental tension here. On the one hand, from the perspective of Iraq alone, in all honesty, is a major oil producer and a major oil reserve holder. Iraq would like to see OPEC stay together and prices to remain relatively high. Whereas the United States, as a major oil consumer, the largest oil consumer and the largest oil importer in the world, has a very different interest. So it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out over time, and I would be loath to make a prediction, but That's going to be the key impact of Iraq is how is this, the changes that have occurred in Iraq as a result of the of the war, how that's going to impact OPEC, whether Iraq is going to be in or out of OPEC, and if it stays in OPEC, what's its position going to be with regards to quotas, enforcing quotas, and so on.
But even, obviously, if the U.S. pulled out of OPEC, that would cause quite a stir.
Absolutely.
But even staying in OPEC, for Iraq to stay in OPEC, doesn't that put strain on the other OPEC countries to cut their own production?
Absolutely. And this is going to be, essentially, cartels like OPEC are inherently unstable. Collectively, it's their incentive to hold production off the market in order to keep prices high. Individually, though, each country would like everybody else to hold output off the market, and it would like to produce flat out everything that it can to take advantage of the high prices. And so, what one would expect is that OPEC coming or Iraq coming back into the market, is particularly as the repairs go on and its productive capacity goes up, that's going to put a lot of pressure on OPEC as Iraq looks to reassert itself and to get its chunk of the market, its market share back again. And then the other OPEC members are going to be faced with a choice that if they want to keep prices high, that's going to force other folks to cut back. And that's everybody would prefer that somebody else do the cutting back. The cartel likes to say, one all for one and one for all. But in reality, it's, every country for itself. Right. And without some mechanism for deterring output increases and price cutting, countries have an incentive to cheat on their cartel agreement.
Well, while I was talking to these oil state professors about the state of oil, something especially interesting was taking place in Dallas, Texas, at the headquarters of one ExxonMobil. Here there were some different opinions about the future state of oil. I decided I'd better find out what was going on, so I spoke to Kurt Davies, the head of research at Greenpeace, about the party they were having in Dallas in the last week of May 2003.
We threw a party at the Exxon AGM the day before the meeting took place. We showed up at their headquarters with 32 members of the Global Warming Crimes Unit. We went inside the building dressed in suits and to deliver our list of charges against the company for sabotaging the Kyoto Protocol and other progress and trying to undermine the science of climate change for more than a decade. We've documented and we've experienced firsthand their abuse of the treaty and their efforts to undermine the scientific dialogue and the policy dialogue. And we consider them the number one roadblock in the corporate community to progress on climate change.
And what was their reaction to the party?
They were not pleased. All of our people, most of our people were arrested and they're all out of jail now. But it got the right reaction. We know that we have to confront them straight on because they're not dealing with this in a responsible way. You look at the behavior of other big companies, including big oil companies, who are both with their public voice and with their actions taking at least slightly more proactive view and approach to global warming and the challenges ahead. And then there's Exxon, which still in some voices denies that there even is a problem. One of the things that we revealed with doing a little bit of sleuthing was that they have given money to front groups, conservative right-wing organizations based here in Washington and around the country whose positions are far to the right even of the Exxon public line. Voices like there isn't even a problem. Is it human? Is it caused by humans? Questioning things that are fundamental facts in the scientific community and questioning the Kyoto Protocol, questioning any movement on monitoring and regulating greenhouse gas emissions. So we feel that this is Exxon's underhanded way through front groups and through these, if you will, cells to express to push the debate farther to the right, away from action. And we don't feel that this is responsible behavior by a company. As the New York Times revealed, no other oil companies are doing this, and Exxon is. They're giving away some $2 million a year to these front groups.
What were the shareholder resolutions that were introduced at the meeting?
The shareholder resolutions that pertain to climate, one was a resolution asking for simply a report from the company. It's the same resolution they've fronted for several years in a row, asking for a report that would simply detail what actions the company is taking on climate and hopefully a proactive position. This is not, the company doesn't want to do this. They don't want to acknowledge that they should do such a report. They don't want to respond to the shareholders. The other one, the other resolution was to have them invest in renewable energy.
What was the result? Did those get voted in?
No, both lost, but lost well. You always generally lose these resolutions, even in the efforts to destroy apartheid through the same tactics where shareholders went to companies and said, we feel it's irresponsible for you to be investing in South Africa, or doing business in South Africa. Those resolutions lost by large margins in the early years, but as soon as they start gaining momentum, the companies pulled out of South Africa. But we feel there is much more that can be done to phase out of fossil fuels and into renewable clean sources of energy.
These days, it's not just the environmental movement and some concerned shareholders going into battle against these oil giants. Another set of equally formidable industry giants, the global reinsurance companies, are starting to flex their muscles in this global battle for green fuels over fossil fuels. Reinsurance companies basically provide insurance to the direct insurance companies that we are more familiar with, who insure our houses, our cars, and our businesses. The two biggest of these, the European-based Swiss Re and Munich Re, provide insurance to insurance companies all over the world to limit the losses of those insurance companies, just like we limit our own losses by buying insurance on our house. And just like you go to Texas to talk oil, you have to go to Switzerland and Germany to talk about important worldly insurance issues. So I asked Thomas Loster in the GeoRisk Research Division at Munich Re in Germany what they think about climate change.
Well, my name is Thomas Loster. I work in the GeoRisk Research Department at the Munich Re Insurance Company. This is the leading reinsurance company of the world, and they want to know about the risks they take. So they have installed a research team looking into the whole global issues, and global warming is a big threat to the communities and might play a role in insurance claims. That's why we do a lot of research in that field.
Can you talk about the trend of insured losses over the past century? Munich Re has a graph of insured losses that's, I guess, become very famous now.
Yes, we have made studies on loss trends, and the figures are really, let's say, exciting. If we compare the 1990s to the 1960s, for example, we see today threefold more big weather-related disasters. We see economic losses have gone up sevenfold and insured losses even tenfold. So the driver of these strong trends is not yet climate or weather. The driver is socioeconomic and its mobility. If you look at the coast, more and more hotels, more and more people, more and more homes and houses, that brings higher loss rates once a storm surge hits the area. So at single spots, if you look at the big cities of the globe or at the cities at the coast, people and values are concentrated, and even a constant nature will affect more people, more houses, more cars. But we see the first signs that there's a change in atmospheric events too. So we see more and more extremes, more extreme rain, heavy rain events, extreme droughts too, and we see major floods around the globe. So Our opinion is if the nature changes and if the atmosphere gets wilder and the environment gets more hostile, then the loss curves will go up steeper, and this is a big problem for the societies and, of course, for the insurance world.
And do you believe that this change in nature is human-induced?
The change in the climate is definitely man-made. This was investigated by a large board of scientists who are all collected in the so-called Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. This is a UN body, a UN research team, a global team, who do research, and they found out that man has influenced climate, and this is bringing the global atmosphere to new levels and more temperature in the atmosphere, more heat. This is means, of course, more hazards because you have more humidity, you have stronger rain events we see now around the globe, and this means we see more floodings.
In the United States, it's often portrayed in the media that there's a lot of scientific debate over whether climate change is human-induced. Is that just the media putting a spin on things to make people think it's uncertain?
The story about the U.S. is very difficult. Just recently, President Bush has accepted that there is a global warming and that it's man-made. The U.S. simply refuses to join in the so-called Kyoto process. This is a global process where the nations of the world try to cut down emissions. And the U.S. situation is that the U.S. are having the biggest emission rates in the world, so they do not want to join this global effort, and they do not want to join in because they would have to cut down their lifestyle and to have to cut down their emissions. That's why the situation is discussed in a different way in the US world. The rest of the world, including Canada and other countries around the US, they all have accepted global warming being real, being a big issue for the whole century, and that's why they all agreed to cut down emissions and to be more energy efficient.
Can you talk about what Munich Re and other reinsurers are doing about the problem of climate change?
Well, Munich Re has installed a research team some 30 years ago, and what we do is, first of all, we try to find out the effects of global warming. And we know how global warming will affect our business, for example, property insurance. And this is, of course, information which is being needed by our colleagues who do global underwriting, who sell policies, because they need to know what risks they are in. A second point is that Munich Re and other leading reinsurance companies, such as the Swiss Re, for example, also communicate a lot. They write publications, they speak at many conferences, also in the political world, and they inform the whole public and the political world about the upcoming threats for the communities and the societies. So it's a big and important role the insurance world, or better, the reinsurance world plays here, because they have been collecting loss data over decades, and of course they are able to evaluate loss data and to derive trend analysis.
You've talked about property insurance. Now, there's been a few stories in the financial press recently about directors and officers insurance, particularly in relation to Swiss Re, mostly Munich Re to some extent, about asking potential clients that you're underwriting for directors and officers insurance what their own climate change strategy is. Can you talk a little bit about that, about what's going on there?
I would say that the awareness about global warming is increasing a lot. It's increasing globally, and Swiss Re started to ask directors and officers whether they know about the problem and whether they have a strategy. If director and officer buys an insurance for his decision making, he needs to prove to the insurance company that he is prepared for a so-called change of risks and that he is prepared and that he has a good strategy.
On the investment side, obviously the insurance industry has a lot of clout because of the trillions of dollars it invests. One thing we haven't seen is an attempt to sort of disinvest or restrict capital going to some of the industries and companies who are primarily responsible for greenhouse gases. Is that something that's on potentially on the horizon?
It's a wrong idea that the insurance industry is invested in the very dirty industries. Take the example of Munich Re. More than 80% of all our assets are in the Dow Jones Sustainability Index, which means we have a totally green and environment-friendly assets portfolio.
So would that exclude someone like ExxonMobil?
So definitely, we have to diversify our risks, and we cannot invest all money into only one strategy. So definitely, we do have a portion assets or investments in companies who are not maybe in the Dow Jones Sustainability Index, but it's a very, very small portion, and we have agreed and we have also published that we want to have a very high rate of environment-friendly and sustainable assets. So it would be wrong to say that the insurers are investing in the dirty world. And last but not least, very important, the very big companies such as Exxon, they are self-insured because they have so much money that they cope with losses and claims themselves, so they don't have the normal insurance package a layperson might assume. And it's a movement going on. So we will have to wait. If you think about the normal environment movement or other political movements, it takes years until improvements of political or societal things really pause through and show up. And I can just say for the sustainability, the financial world has now found out that it's a big issue and they have started the process, and we cannot expect overnight the very big steps, but a very strong movement is taking place. I mean, if you think about human rights or other processes about apartheid, it takes years and decades until you finally are where you want to be. And I can promise you that for the sustainable world, the insurance and financial world will be much faster than other political processes. And if we start waiting and we see, for example, in the US, more droughts, more forest fires, stronger storms, then the affected will be the losers. So we should really, from a business side, but also from a personal side, really take the whole thing very serious and act. Otherwise, we will see us in a very hostile environment in a few decades.
Apparently, not all insurers are quite so active in this mission to stem climate change. And it seems that some of the US insurance companies are not so serious about slaying the fossil fuel dragon.
I'm a knight of the square table.
Square table?
Well, you see, King Arthur doesn't think I'm cool and hip enough to be on the round table on account of I'm not really into war at all. Look, flowers on the end of my lance. Oh. And you know, if I ever have to fight a dragon, I'd try and look at it from the dragon's point of view.
Oh, that's beautiful. Hippie knight.
Kurt Davies from Greenpeace gives a summary of their experiences in working with the insurance sector.
The interesting trend for the last about 6 or 7 years is that the insurance sector knows that climate change will affect their bottom line. They know that more weather disasters will hurt them. And yet the reaction, especially in the U.S. insurance industry, has been, we can't do anything ourselves to stop it, so we'll just raise the rates. So, for example, in Florida, you either can't get hurricane insurance or it costs an awful lot. The upstream reinsurance industry, their reaction, having to basically insure the insurance industry, is more panicked because they know they have to cover all the losses. They're fully aware. You know, they get it. They watch weather. They have weather experts. They have, you know, basically have climatologists, you know,
looking for risk on board already, and that you know, that they were almost aware of the problem ahead of us, the possibility, and they deal in risk assessment. You know, you deal, that's what your profession is looking at probabilities of risk, right? So on a very pure sort of academic level, you would expect that the insurance industry would have a good base of knowledge with which to deal with this this specter. And now we feel this head in the sand approach of the U.S. insurance industry is pretty ridiculous, and that they are a very powerful force, and they could be much more proactive. Greenpeace has been working with the insurance industry since the early 90s. In fact, there was a conference held in 1991 in Florida, actually, with the insurance industry, where we saw some real consciousness and some hope that they could be a proactive force to push for a good climate treaty and absolute reductions in greenhouse gases. Early on, when the environmental community was looking for allies on the global warming fight, the insurance industry, cued by the weather disaster specter, was an obvious candidate. And, you know, as I said, there were some really interesting early discussions. And then at some point, the U.S., especially the U.S. insurers, just turned off and said, we're not going to deal with this. We'll just raise our rates accordingly.
And so have you worked then with the European reinsurers?
Not personally, but institutionally, yes, and as have other environmental groups. I can give you a couple names of people who have worked really closely with Swiss Re and Munich Re. World Wildlife Fund has done a bit of work with them, as have some of the socially responsible investment community folks, same folks who were hammering Exxon yesterday at the annual general meeting. They've had a really good dialogue with the reinsurers. Swiss Re held a conference last year in New York. There's some good material out of that. They get it. They know that it's big. I mean, the figures they threw out, when was that? Last June, $300 billion. I don't even remember what the number was, but it was enormous. It's big enough to send a shockwave through the industry. One would hope that the reinsurers would have enough muscle to be able to push the insurance industry generally to be more proactive.
Swiss Re is sending out a questionnaire for directors and officers insurance. They're asking companies what they're doing about global warming and what
That's
their policy
a result
is.
Of this meeting last summer. I didn't get the
okay, but it's been covered fairly well in the Wall Street Journal.
Yeah,
and so it remains to be seen as to what extent they will raise premiums or refuse to cover companies that are not that don't have a decent climate change policy.
That is an amazing action by the company in itself. I mean, that there is even a letter or a questionnaire or a signal being sent by Swiss Re is an enormous step. You know, if they're sending that to other corporate players saying, how are you dealing with this? Here are the facts. That's big. And I think that shouldn't be underestimated.
The other way that the insurance industry has clout is obviously it's one of the largest investors, has a huge amount of funds to invest.
Yes.
And potentially they could try and restrict capital to the dirty industries.
That's right. And that's the dialogue that's been going on with the SRI community, the socially responsible investing community.
Quite undeterred by the findings of the UN panel on climate change and the 30 years of study at the big reinsurance companies, some oil consultants and researchers are determined to believe that fossil fuels do not cause climate change. Here's Professor Economides from the University of Houston again.
You realize that the whole rhetoric of global warming is probably the most intellectually dishonest rhetoric ever since snake oil. There is no connection between global warming, the so-called global warming, and anything being anthropogenic, that is humanly created. There is no connection between global warming and the production of carbon dioxide. In fact, our calculations suggest that carbon dioxide should increase to as much as 5% of the atmosphere to rationalize a wholesale increase in temperature, not the parts per million that it is right now.
So are you saying that companies like Munich Re and Swiss Re are wrong when they say that climate change is induced and that they shouldn't be worried about their losses on the property casualty books?
Yes, they are. And in fact, I think that there is no scientific evidence that convinces me that there is any connection between the production of carbon dioxide and so-called global warming.
And who funds your research projects?
I have had funding from the United States government. I have had projects with Halliburton, projects with Shell Oil Company. I have had research funded by El Paso Corporation, which is a natural gas company. Several companies.
And do you think your opinion is biased by the fact that their interests are in... Because if you're funded by parties whose interests are in saying that climate change is not human-induced...
Listen, I would like to see the evidence for the anthropogenic connection. I mean, show me the evidence. Where is the evidence of the connection?
Isn't it sufficient to say that the humans do increase the amount of greenhouse gases and greenhouse gases cause climate change?
No, it's not sufficient at all. In fact,
why?
In fact, this kind of thing is nonsense.
Where's the fault in that argument?
The fault is this, it's not enough. Okay.
But is the fault in saying that humans, do you disagree that humans do not produce greenhouse gases? Is that what you're saying?
First of all, the term greenhouse
say gases, carbon dioxide, carbon-based gases.
A biased statement. Look, it's the same thing. How much sugar do you need to sweeten a glass of milk?
No, but I'm just asking you a simple question. Do you think that humans...
It depends on the degree.
So you're saying the degree at which we produce carbon gases does not cause climate change?
Oh, absolutely. It's thermodynamically impossible that we produce enough CO2 for something we call vapor-liquid equilibrium, elevate the temperature of the Earth to the degree that we have observed. I believe the sun...
So are you going to call up the big reinsurance companies and tell them they have nothing to worry about?
I would say, no, I'm not saying that climate change shouldn't worry the insurance and the insurance companies. In fact, there has been tremendous climatological changes 700 years ago. They caused probably diseases. There are many things that are caused by climatological changes.
So you're saying that climate change it's a coincidence that we produce a whole lot of carbon gases. It's just a coincidence that we're also experiencing climate change.
Let me put it to you this way. How much carbon gases we produce would be for somebody to expect with one grain of sugar to sweeten a glass of milk? It's just not going to happen.
Many oil industry analysts see the demand for and use of oil continuing to increase for decades to come and can't see how transportation can possibly get away from the fossil fuels. But then again, so people with wood chip cars and buses early in the 20th century might have thought similarly about their dependence on chopping down trees for transport. Like many people my age, I've learned everything I know about cars from the radio program Car Talk, including the following nugget of information.
Hello, you're on Car Talk.
Hi, this is Gina Davis. Hi, guys.
Gina Davis, like the actress?
Just like the actress, yeah.
How much like the actress?
Like totally, yeah.
Get out. No kidding. What in the world makes a Hollywood actress of your stature lower herself to call us?
Wood chip burning engine.
Oh, jeez, no.
You have one. I'm going to...
You too, huh?
I heard that call from Hans last week.
Yeah.
And you guys were sort of disbelieving, but I figured that my dad would know. If anything like that had existed, my dad would probably be a guy that would know.
Yeah.
And
we should
enough,
probably fill in our listeners, who some of whom don't listen every week. We got a call last week from a fellow named Hans that said he was a kid at the end of World War II in Germany, and he remembers, but he wasn't sure because he was only a kid, that they were escaping from someplace, probably from the Russians, and they were driving along and stopping periodically to put more wood chips or something into this engine, into this gasoline car, you know, and some kind of a tank, and they were driving along, basically, he said, using wood as a fuel. And we said, get out! So you, Gina, think that your dad knows about this, you said?
Well, he served in India during World War II, and when they were on their way over, they stopped in Algeria, and there he saw that the buses were run with wood chip engines.
Yeah.
The old funky buses had this big sort of box hanging off the back of the bus, and they filled it up with wood chips.
Yeah. Well, I have to say, we've gotten literally thousands of emails from people telling us what those were.
Oh.
Yeah, we now know how it works.
Oh, how does it work? Dad didn't know how it works.
Oh, he didn't know how it works.
No, he assumed it made some sort of gas, but...
Well, here's what happens, I guess. You heat the wood up, and when you do that, if you get it hot enough, you produce gases. And one of the gases you produce, I guess, when you drive the gas off the wood is methane.
Mm. And it burns.
Which is what natural gas is methane, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes,
right.
It is.
Right.
So what you're doing is you're heating the wood up hot enough, which is the same thing that happens, by the way.
I think they call it wood gas, as a matter of fact.
Mm. Yeah, which is the same thing, by the way, which makes wood burn.
Hmm.
Yeah.
When you have a piece of wood burning in your fireplace, what's actually burning is the methane.
Right, because
you're heating up the wood enough to have it give off gas, and it's that gas that's burning. So if instead of heating it up to the point where you're burning, you just heat it up, you can capture the gas and burn it in the engine.
Oh,
so
thank you very much.
Why did you call us, Gina?
I just wanted to find out if I could put wood chips in my SUV.
Yeah, you can. You just stuff them right there in the gas tank. The SUV is made so that it automatically converts everything.
So if people can go from using wood chip cars to gasoline cars, then who knows what could be next? Professor Economides argues that much of the world's current energy problems will be solved by natural gas and hydrogen fuels.
The problem with oil, and in fact, so-called environmental issues, whether they are fact or fiction, are all going to be remedied eventually by the fact that natural gas, I believe, will become the premier fuel of the future of the world. You see, the decarbonization of fuels, in other words, using lower and lower carbon atoms, is a historical imperative that has very little to do with environmental ideologues like most of the global warming crowd. I think using lower and lower carbon molecules, which is a process that started 200 years ago, where wood was the main energy source, eventually to coal, that fueled the industrial revolution, to oil, arguably the fuel of the 20th century, and now eventually to natural gas, all of that using smaller and smaller carbon atoms is, in fact, a necessary transition. We are going into more and more efficient engines. It's the economy that actually will push the use of cleaner fuels, cleaner in the sense of having lower carbon ratios compared to hydrogen. Eventually, it's going to be hydrogen, but hydrogen is going to come from hydrocarbons, not from water, of course, where the energy to separate hydrogen is more than the energy content of the separated hydrogen. So there is going to be a new fuel. That's going to be natural gas. And all of that may resolve all of this silliness about global warming, because I definitely think that natural gas will be the fuel of the future. It will lend itself to much more refined engines, smaller engines. You may have heard the term nanotechnology, small engines. So I see a future where the engines of our future will be smaller, more efficient, using lower carbon molecules, but not because of global warming and nonsense like that, but because they are going to be more efficient. I think fuel cells, for instance, are just around the corner. And I think fuel cells will do to the internal combustion engine what it did to the steam engine 100 years ago. So, yes, I think the fuel of the world will change. It's going to be natural gas.
Whereabouts do you get, you know, natural gas and hydrogen? Is that faced with the same geopolitical issues as oil?
That's interesting, by the way. That's a very good point. Oil causes geopolitical vulnerabilities. Five of the six countries have 75 billion barrels of proven reserves, are all in the Persian Gulf. That's Iran, Iraq, Kuwait, the United Arab Emirates, and the biggest of them all, Saudi Arabia. The sixth, by the way, is Venezuela with its own problems. There are 12 countries, at least 12 countries, perhaps as many as 36 countries, scattered all over the world that can actually provide natural gas reserves of world class. So natural gas not only is cleaner, not only is a better fuel, it also doesn't have these geopolitical vulnerabilities that you get because of the concentration of oil resources.
Professor Gately at New York University was a little more hopeful about the so-called renewable energies.
There have been big improvements over the past 25 years in the cost of the alternatives. Solar power has come down dramatically. Biomass has come down dramatically in terms of its cost. But still, those are not competitive in many applications with conventional fossil fuels such as oil and natural gas. So at least at the range of prices that we're talking about now, I don't see there's much likelihood for expansion of alternative energy sources, certainly not into transportation markets. It's conceivable, of course, if there are big improvements in technology that can get the cost down, these technologies may become competitive, but whether that's going to happen in the next 15, 20, 25 years depends more on technology than on anything else. With respect to climate change, the growing use of energy as world economies, especially in Asia, as they continue to develop, they're likely to want to increase their consumption of commercial energy. That means fossil fuels, primarily oil, natural gas, and coal. So it's inevitable that there are going to be increases in carbon dioxide emissions. It's hard for me to imagine a world in which carbon dioxide emissions are not going to continue to increase almost as rapidly as they have for the past two decades or five decades or 10 decades.
In the next part of this series, we'll investigate where the status of renewable energies really stands, and we'll learn more about how, much to some people's amazement, the environmental community is starting to work more with the investment community in the battle against fossil fire. That's all for Wizards of Money Part 20. Note that the Wizards of Money has a website at wizardsofmoney.org where you can get the text of all episodes and can get further references.